Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the Haddit.com Radio Show. Haddit.com Radio is an in-depth look at all things VA. If you need help with the VA, log on to Haddit.com. Now, here's your host, Gerald Cook.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, on this 25th day of July, 2019. We're here with our co-host, Jay Basser. And today we have Dr. Batch and Bill Krieger on. And hopefully we're going to be able to answer some questions for y'all. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to call in. We'd appreciate hearing from you. Our call-in number is 347-237-4819. Now that call-in number once again is 347-237-4819, and you hit number one, and that'll bring you right into the queue here with us. If we see you in here, we'll try to identify you and get you on the air. We do have a caller in here, a 301, I believe. 301 area code, do you have a question or comment before we get started?
Yes, sir. I was calling I have two questions, actually, for Dr. Bass. One question is, I want to do a claim for diabetes because I was diagnosed with it after 1 year of leaving service, right?
Yes.
But I feel that I had the symptoms while serving, I had like elevated blood sugars, but not to the point where they would be diagnosed as diabetes, right? But, you know, I think I felt I had adverse effects as a result of being pre-diabetic, you know, while serving, but just so happened, you know, I didn't get diagnosed until, like I said, after the 1 year of leaving service. So, I've also been diagnosed with sleep apnea, so I don't know if there's a way that, you know, there's a nexus there where that could, you know, be linked to that. But I guess I just want to figure out how I can go about getting the diabetes, rated as service connected.
Right.
And then,
go ahead, second question.
No. And then the second question is, on my separation physical, right, I claimed GERD, right, but was denied by the VA. But, again, after 1 year of separation, I went in and had a scope completed, and sure enough, the doc pretty much said, yep, you have, acid reflux, acid reflux. Not so much GERD, but acid reflux. So I guess with that being said, I don't know if that could be secondary to something, or how would I go about claiming that as well, or... Yeah, so that's my two questions.
Oh. Yep. So GERD, you had symptoms of GERD in service, pretty much. You said you claimed it.
Yeah, my symptoms were in service, so I claimed it, and then they had me go to one of those, examinations with a private, provider, and I guess they didn't feel that I had it, but it's ironic. When I went to the VA hospital, like I said, it was after a year, and sure enough, they ran that scope, and they was like, yep, you have it. So it's after a year, so I'm just trying to figure out how to go about doing it.
Yeah. They need an nexus opinion. The first thing I'd say about the GERD, though, is make sure you get that checked up every year because that GERD can turn into cancer. Can go to something called Barrett's esophagus, and that can turn into throat cancer, and that's very deadly. It only happens to about 5 or 10% of people, but you want to make sure that gets cleared up because that's like a medical problem you got to make sure you keep on top of. So we see that a lot where you have symptoms in service, like for the GERD, and then you go outside for a QTC exam. The VA has strict rules on the QTC exam, and oftentimes they'll deny it. But I could write an Nexus letter about that. And what I would do is say that the GERD symptoms were present in service and you had them continuously throughout afterwards. We'll do a lay letter about that. And then I can use that scope and say the GERD was connected to service. There's some strict rules about that one-year time period. Bill could talk about some of those rating rules, but the medical theory makes lots of sense to me. Now, the GERD can be a nice cause for your sleep apnea, and I do that a lot. I've got nice literature that talks about GERD causing sleep apnea, so I would do that probably as a secondary condition to the GERD and catch your sleep apnea that way. That's
I've already been diagnosed with sleep apnea, Dr. Bash.
Yep.
I have a rating for that. CPAP machine, right. And I have a rating.
Yep. And the same thing goes like for the diabetes. Now, your symptoms in the service, sometimes they have strict rules about what they'll allow, but for me, if your symptoms are there, I can write a Nexus letter about diabetes starting in service and continuing afterwards.
Yeah,
I always like to look for a cause.
I'm curious.
Diagnosis
of diabetes was more than 1 year after service, but just how long after service?
You say how long after service? Let me see. So I separated in, I had my exam in December 2014. So it was around about 2017, right? And the ironic part, was for my retirement physical, I think I had high blood sugar levels then. So the examining physician, opted to say, well, hey, I'm going to put you on this medication. I want you to come back for me to do your lab work for my retirement physical. And then once my blood sugars were within control, then, of course, he didn't write it up with the diabetes as well, which I found to be ironic.
Yeah. So you had presumptive diagnosis.
That's some great That's some great documentation. If we get our hands on it, that shows the elevated blood sugar and treatment for it.
Right.
Now, Dr. Bash can take a look at those values, what medication was used, and Dr. Bash, after he takes a look at those and sees what they were, could decide for us, could opine that represented the onset of diabetes. Now, diabetes is a disease of the endocrine system and has been deemed by VA as chronic disease. So if Dr. Bash finds that record that shows that test and the treatment and concludes that was diabetes, then subsequent manifestations, however remote from service, are by definition service-connected. And so that's something that can be won. Diabetes is very insidious. It's very slow developing. It didn't happen, in a year. It took time to manifest to the degree. First, there were some symptoms that brought you in for care, and you probably gave that doctor a history.
Retirement, because it was for my separation physical, right? Mm-hmm. I guess the standard practice, they do lab work, right?
Yeah,
so,
that part. Sorry, I didn't mean to confuse you. That part, I understand. It was a separation physical when you had a test and some medication. Now, you said you were diagnosed several years after service, like 3 years, I think it was.
Yes.
Now, when you went in and got that diagnosis, the doctor typically will ask you, well, what brings you here and how long have you had this problem? And your answer could give us great insight as to when that began. And that's some very relevant and very important evidence. We get our hands on that and that work that was done in service sounds like it could be a very strong case just based on this initial conversation.
What Bill's talking about is continuous symptoms. The symptoms you had during that gap period are very important. It's associated with an ongoing process. Yeah. In my mind, when I hear that story about the treatment, that's like a presumptive diagnosis because that doctor made the decision in his mind that you had diabetes and starting to treat it right off the bat. So that's good. What caused the diabetes? Do you have it? Is there were you exposed to toxins, or you know, was there anything that caused it?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know. I did serve in the first Gulf War, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's any correlation there with the you know environmental concerns, but but I noticed you know when upon returning from the Persian Gulf, you know back in 91 time frame, that my vitality and everything wasn't the same as prior to going over there, right? And
that's
give you a case in point. I was gonna say case in point was like even though I give you an example, so like even I would train, like, you know, just to be the, you know, physically fit soldier that I can be. And it seemed like, I don't care how much I train, I could never get to, like a peak level of fitness because just the way my body felt, right?
Breathing?
Or, you know,
was
whatever was going on.
Was it breathing? You have problems with your lungs?
I'm sorry, say again?
Oh, did you have problems with your lungs, breathing problems?
Yeah, it seemed like my lungs, muscles, all that,
Well, yeah, so there's a couple ways. Like Bill said, one way is to do the continuous symptoms from service. And another way to think about it is to see if you're exposed to some toxins, which can cause diabetes straight out. And the third thing you mentioned was maybe you might have some pulmonary disease, too, because a lot of soldiers were exposed to dust and aerosolized toxins, and they have lung disease, which decreases their vitality. So it might even be that you have a claim for lung disease to look at, too.
And I'm glad you brought up the lungs, Dr. Bash, because, like, I've, you know, throughout my career, like, experienced wheezing, you know, difficulty breathing. And they had me do the pulmonary function test as a part of my separation physical. And they said that the ranges were within normal ranges for me blowing into that tube. But people who serve, like, in Persian Gulf, they say there's another test that's more appropriate. DOD didn't administer to me.
There's a couple of special tests you can do. What happens, you breathe that stuff in, the lungs are like a filter, and it gets in the interstitium, which is like those little walls between the alveoli, and it gets plugged up and the air can't get across. So what you do is you do this test called a diffusion test, and they give you a gas to breathe, and they measure your blood and see how much gets across. And a lot of times that test will show some lung disease. Another test that I do sometimes is a thin slice, high-resolution CT scan, and you can use that to try and look at the images and see if you can see some thickening of those little walls. So those are two specialized tests that, in a case like this, we might order and see if we have some positive results and then try and help you get connected to that. So, it's good. Good questions.
Okay. Well, thank you. I definitely have to follow up with you after this session.
Yeah. Hey, Bill, do you have any more words on legal aspects of it? Or ratings asking?
Yeah, that's certainly something we need to explore. And of course, if it turns out that there is no explanation for the symptoms and it's a undiagnosed illness that's affecting you, that could possibly also be presumed to be service connected. We spoke before about a multi-system undiagnosed disease that's presenting symptomatic limitations, that VA is empowered to grant presumptive service connection in Gulf War veterans. So that's something we'll need to explore.
Carl, do you understand what Bill just said?
Yeah, about the undiagnosed.
Yeah,
I believe so,
yes. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's like a Joker card. So sometimes there's diseases that we don't know about even in medicine, and there's diseases that are in the war zone that we don't know about. So VA recognizes that these things are mystery diseases, and they give you credit for it.
Okay. So I do have one last question. So, like, let me ask you, so based on what I've shared with you all today, like, what's your typical, like, rate or, you know, fees to I mean, just give me a ballpark, like, what would, you know, it cost for me to get this addressed so that I can file?
Yeah. Well, I do my pricing kind of individual with each person, because if I say something on the radio, then everybody's going to say, hey, that's the price for everybody. So it all depends on how thick the record is and how much you might have other medical opinions, and we might do more, you know, more. We might have six claims by the time we're done instead of just one or two. But you call me. We'll talk about the fall, and then we'll set up the price, and then we'll go off it.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, I definitely will be giving you a call.
You want to go ahead and give me your number, Dr. Bash?
Yeah. The good way to get me is through my other guy that does my scheduling, Skip. And he's at 925-381-7561.
Okay, you kind of went fast. 925.
Yep, 381-7561. 7561.
Yeah, okay, so 925-381-7561.
Yep, he's in California. So just call Skip up, and then he gets me the next day or two, and then we make a little 15, half-hour, minute call. It's good news for you now that the VA is processing claims pretty quickly. I had a guy last week that had his VA exam, and 5 days later he had his claim processed. So it's important for us to get the claims done up right at first, that they get processed quickly now.
Right. Okay.
Well, that sounds good. Thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you. I mean, so I guess if I just want to listen to the rest of the podcast, is that possible, or?
Oh, yeah, I'll just say right where you're at.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you might want to have another question pop up, but no.
Exactly.
Jump right in.
Dr. Bash, my new phone-friendly website goes online tomorrow, so, Carl, you can check that out and find me that way, too.
Okay.
Just Google Dr. Bash.
Yep.
Good.
Yep. Google Dr. Bash. Google Veterans Medical Opinion. You can Google that, and you'll get 53 million pages. And I show up on the first line or something like that. It's crazy. So we're going to talk about DVQs maybe. So my normal package is for the caller. It's like I do a Nexus letter, number one. Number two, I do DBQs. Number three, I'll do testing. The caller just talked about some questions, and we had some testing. Number four, we'll do like a lay letter. Number five, we'll do like my resume. And number six, we might do, you know, add your medical information or other doctor opinions. So like six parts to it, might be 100 pages. You send them all in, you know, three or four ways so that you can't lose them. But one of those big components is the DBQs. And so, Bill could give us a history on DVQs a little bit. We can talk about how we use them on a daily basis.
Oh, yeah, sure. That was some years ago they began. And I think one of the motivation was two parts. One, you know, we had general requests in VA there where those of us on the rating board would want an examination. We would order an examination. And what we would get back sometimes would provide a lot of good data, but would leave very important relevant findings off the exam and didn't answer specific questions we needed in order to select the proper evaluation. So VA established a committee and started developing these DBQ forms. And these forms were designed with the intent to solicit the specific findings the rater has to have in order to compare that to the rating schedule. And the second prong of that effort was to make these forms available to veterans so that they could have the form completed by a doctor of their choice, and it would solicit the relevant data from that doctor. And part of the reasoning was the more veterans who get their own doctor to complete the forms, the fewer comp exams we have to do, and it eases the burden on VA to have to schedule so many exams.
These DVQs are really tricky. They can be 177 questions. And each one has a bunch of laws behind it. Bill talked about me and the amputation part, but keep going, Bill. Sorry.
Yeah, there. Some of them get pretty lengthy because there are so many questions posed as the courts review the rating schedule and the VA's decisions of the Board of Veterans Appeals, and they might come up with a need to remand the case from the court back to the board to say, well, look, you made this conclusion, but the examiner didn't answer that question. So by soliciting the question on the DBQ, that will reduce the number of cases that have to be remanded. And sometimes the court then will impose additional requirements that VA must address before evaluating the disability. Well, one of the problems is the need for VA to follow its own rules. And many times the court had to remand cases to simply say to VA, VA, you're required to follow your own regulations. And so if you give an examination and your examination doesn't describe functional impairment on use or after repeated motion, then you have to get a new exam that describes that because your regulations say that's part of the evaluation. And so the VA would then add a criteria to discuss that. Another one happened again when there was a need to compare to the sound side and some other criteria that the court discussed in a case, it was called Kuwaya, and the VA then incorporated that into the examination form to prompt the doctor to answer those specific questions, things like on weight bearing and not on weight bearing by comparison. So this process evolves, and there's sort of a feedback loop between the field and the committee going back and forth and constantly massaging these documents, generally increasing the number of questions on them. And sometimes Dr. Bash and I were just reviewing an interesting case. Sometimes what we get from the VA exam is incomplete. And it's incomplete because they didn't do the follow-up exam. And for example, if, since we were on the diabetes topic earlier, diabetes as it continues to develop, I think somebody's got an open mic going on here doing dishes or something. Diabetes tends to progress over time. And as it does, it then starts to present complications, like some numbness and tingling in the toes, perhaps some cataracts. So we have these complications that arise as diabetes progresses. So the intent and what the manual provides is, if you have a veteran with diabetes and you're going to try to evaluate it, you get the DBQ for diabetes. That examiner will identify all the complications that are present. Then each of those complications goes to a specialist in that area. For example, if it's causing a diabetic neuropathy, it goes for a neurology exam for the peripheral nerves. If it's starting to affect the renal system, it goes to a genitourinary examiner or an ophthalmologist for those complications of vision. So sometimes we'll get a basic exam, like in the case Dr. Bash and I recently reviewed, where the veteran has Parkinson's disease. Well, the Parkinson's disease is presenting a variety of complications, one of which is neurologic, obviously. And it's causing the patient to have tremors. But we don't have the follow-up neurology exam that'll tell us which nerve distributions this disease is presenting. So we don't know if it's the median nerve, the lower radicular group, or all the radicular groups. Not to get too technical, but it makes a difference in the rating schedule. Which nerves are affected could carry a higher evaluation. We just simply don't have that neurology exam, so we don't know what the evaluation should be. In that case, we're going to be seeking some new exams.
So, this is Dr. Bash, but that's like what Bill's saying, is those DVQs, they're complicated in themselves because the questions all have a lot of laws behind them. So the average doctor doesn't necessarily know the ramifications of that. And also, the average doctor doesn't know that you can get layers and layers of DVQs like Bill was talking about, where one DVQ points to another and you have different systems that are involved. And also, you know, the doctor can do the DVQs as a non-specialist, and then that sort of forces the VA to do their own sets of DVQs with their own specialist, maybe, if they don't like it. So you can use the DVQs to your advantage in a lot of ways if you understand how they're put together and the importance of them.
Yeah. Important tool, and it's important to use correctly.
Now, I have a lady that does some lay letter writing for us. Is Gail on there? I don't know if Gail's on there. Maybe not. Anyway, she's going to come on later on and talk to us a little bit about lay letters. Another part of how they interface with DVQs and the Nexus letter. So we had a lady last week that had upper, middle, and lower back. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Oh, that's very interesting. Very interesting. My goodness, we have a noise here in the background. Veteran had a skiing accident off a cliff. It was a very long fall. Appears to have lost some consciousness. Filed a claim and said lower, middle, and upper back. And they granted the lumbar. Okay. Well, now the question is, what about, you know, she claimed three segments, lower, middle, and upper. Well, the spine, by definition, has three segments, lumbar and thoracic and cervical. So what about the other two? You know? The VA just left that unanswered. And so what we're trying to do now is to help VA understand that the original claim was for three segments of the spine, and by definition, that includes the thoracic and the cervical as well as the lumbar, and we're hoping to be able to persuade VA to take service connection back to the original data claim. It's a reasonable argument, and we hope VA gets a reasonable response. But there was it's very interesting that Dr. Bash noted in her records there were was bruising on the back at the level of the scapulae. Dr. Bash recognized that provides corroboration that this with impact would affect the neck and the head, because she couldn't possibly have landed like that without applying these forces onto the neck in a whiplash sort of manner, and also onto the head with loss of consciousness. And the veteran herself actually had very little recollection of what happened after impact, and didn't actually realize that she was unconscious. But as it turns out, she's not aware of anything until her friends came to her rescue. And so there's a blank period of time there. So this loss of consciousness and a forcible blow to the head is one of the indications to suggest the possibility of traumatic brain injury. And she now has maybe five symptoms consistent with a diagnosis of TBI. So we're anxious to get her examined to confirm or rule out the diagnosis and to identify those symptoms. And if correct, that would be a substantial more compensation available to her than she realized. So we're hoping for some good things for that case.
So that case brings up the idea of 1,000 questions. You know, Bill and I, when we talk to patients, we ask 1,000 questions. And like the first caller, pretty soon you find out he has lung disease and secondary complications. And this patient, you find out that she has neck disease and maybe, you know, head injury. So, you know, appropriate questioning with a curious mind and with the mind to try and help the patient can make a big difference versus, you know, closing new questions and trying to decrease the amount of disability.
Hey,
yeah.
Guys, we've got another caller.
Okay, good.
Harry Colt 612, do you have a question for the staff? Harry Colt 612, you in there from Minnesota?
Yep. This is Gail.
Hey, Gail.
Hi, it's Dr.
Oh, our Gail?
I work with Dr. Bash.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Yeah, it's our Gail. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome to the show, Gail.
Thanks. I was calling because Dr. Bash and I wanted to let the listeners know how important lay statements are to their whole claim package. Right, Dr. Bash?
That's right. That's right. So, so Gail's doing some lay letter coaching, and Gail, you look at the nexus and you look at the DVQs and try and weave them together in a way. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. It's almost like a bridge. When you do a nexus and you do DVQs, your lay statements are in my opinion, equally important, because you need to discuss all the disabilities in your lay statement that you're discussing in your nexus. So you need to start out with what happened to you, what event or injury you had, what happened right after the event or injury. Did you go to the clinic? Did you have a profile? And then you want to discuss what's happening with your life right now and talk about specific situations that you may not be able to do anymore due to your injury.
Yeah, how much time do you spend on a lay letter analysis with somebody average?
Well, depending on how many different disabilities we're talking about, sometimes you can group them together. If you have a lot of spine disabilities, say you have neck and shoulder problems, you can talk about those in one letter. If you have PTSD, that should be a separate letter, but I would say that each letter is an hour or two with the interview, discussing and talking about the things that you can't do anymore, how you were injured. So, I mean, one letter sometimes can take 3-4 hours.
Yeah. So Gail's doing a good service for us, because that's a lot of time that I might not be able to put in, and Bill can't put in, you know, 4 hours on each patient necessarily just for the lay letter part of it. And then Bill
right.
knows about the laws, right? Bill, the laws that help us establish lay letter importance.
Yes, and I might mention that historically, the success that Dr. Bash has had has often been predicated on his ability to listen to the veteran and to consider what the veteran is saying in the way of that history of symptoms. And in this way, we have seen Dr. Bash win a great number of cases by disagreeing with the VA examiner and by pointing out that the VA examiner failed to discuss that lay history, which is crucial. I mean, and oft times I had to try to coach some of my raters who I worked with to help them understand that the law does not require a history of treatment and diagnosis. The law
hey, Bill,
considers
say that again. Say
symptoms.
That again, Bill. Say that again.
The law does not require consistency or continuity of treatment or examination. It requires a consideration of the history of symptoms,
mm-hmm.
not diagnosis or treatment. And so many times, particularly with many patients with multiple sclerosis that we've had, many times these patients have no clue what the symptoms of multiple sclerosis might include. So you really have to ask them about their experiences to try to draw out from them symptoms that they've had in the past that they didn't consider to be part of their multiple sclerosis because they didn't have the knowledge to understand that. A lot of our multiple sclerosis wins came as a result of Dr. Bash being able to put together that patient's history of symptoms and that no one else bothered soliciting, okay,
mm-hmm.
and then pointing to these as evidence of this waxing and waning early history of MS that the patient didn't realize was MS, and in this way get those symptoms dated to service or dated to that 7-year presumptive period after service and get a win and get compensated. Crucial.
Right, and I agree with that, Bill, because when I am talking to the veterans and trying to pull out some of that information, for instance, with a somebody that has PTSD and they're unable to, like, hold a full-time job, and when you get into a conversation with them and you start talking about what kind of job that they're working in, and sometimes they're chaotic environments and they just can't understand why they can't hold a job when there's so much background noise going on. And so you start getting to those kind of things and explaining it, and it kind of becomes more clear to them. And they want to blame themselves, of course, but it's a symptom of PTSD. Same with being able to just little things like when you have back problems or radiating pain and you can't sit on the floor with your kids anymore and play with them, or you can't go to their after-school programs. Those are little teeny situations that I like to write about because it kind of, for me, it brings the reader to, oh, I have kids. It would be horrible if I couldn't go do those kind of things with them. So try and bring in kind of examples like that into our letters.
This brings up the whole idea of being stoic. A lot of times veterans, you know, aren't supposed to complain in service and be stoic. And
right.
So all listeners should know that if they talk to Alice, it's part of our team, or Skip, or myself, or Gail, or Bill, or even Megan, feel free to try and tell us what your problems are so that we can sort of root out where you are in your situation. Hey, Bill, there's some laws, right, Bill? There's some laws about late letters? Well, you said about that, but you don't need to quote those. But you said
I'll say it. Say again, Doc?
All those laws. There's some laws. We don't necessarily need to quote those, but there's 2 or 3 different case laws and studies that talk about the value of lay letters. The judges in the courts have codified this too, huh?
Yes. The court all along, case after case, would come up to the court, and the court would set aside the denial by BVA with instruction that they are required to consider the lay evidence. You know, it's finally making its way into the guidance that VA shares with its employees. The manual, M21, we always go back to that because it serves as the guidebook for all the employees at VA. And its current version now does a pretty good job of instructing people that the statement of a veteran. Now, I've got to make a caveat here. The sworn statement of a veteran, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In order to be evidence, it must be sworn. So that's why if you've ever looked on the VA form 214138, which is just a big blank paper with lines on it, down the bottom, there is that affirmation. I hereby swear and affirm this is true and correct to my best knowledge and belief, okay?
That makes
it a sworn statement. Yeah?
Would it be advisable to even have it notarized?
Not
it may
necessary.
Not be necessary,
it's not relevant.
But it wouldn't
just,
make it.
It would. Obviously, if it's before a notary, it's sworn, and there could be no debate. But as long as it has that statement on there somewhere that you see on the 4138, I do hereby swear and affirm this is true and correct to the best of my knowledge and belief. As long as that's on there, it's evidence. Now,
okay.
I will say this. I have never in my experience, 40 whatever years, I have never seen a decision maker reject the evidence because it's not sworn. But because VA has now taken the time to amend the manual and put it in there, that's a red flag. That's a red flag to me. If the central office thinks it's an important enough an issue to change the manual and to highlight the need for the affirmation, to me that says we better make sure that all of our statements contain that affirmation. the manual actually says now to accept that veteran's sworn statement as factual unless there's evidence to the contrary. Okay? So if a veteran says to us, I was on board an aircraft carrier at Yankee Station off the coast of Vietnam, and I took a flight over to Da Nang and picked up, you know, some supplies and brought them back to the ship, okay? He tells us, his sworn statement is, he did that. That is evidence that he set foot in Vietnam, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Unless VA adjudicator has a reason to disagree, then it's a fact. And I recall one particular instance where I made a substantial award of herbicide-related disease compensation, and management questioned me and said, "Well, why did you do this?" And I looked back at him and said, "Why shouldn't I?" And he said, "Well, his military records don't confirm that he set foot in Vietnam." I say, "Of course not." I said to him, "Okay, what did he tell us?" "Well, he said he landed in Da Nang and took a hop out to the carrier. I got there." "Okay. We do know that he was in Southern California on day one, and we know within days he's on the aircraft carrier in the South China Sea. Now, I got to tell you, buddy, at that time we had no aircraft that could take off in California and land on an aircraft carrier in the South China Sea." "No, and that is not typical. Da Nang was the support facility supporting the ships at Yankee Station off the coast. It was routine for personnel, mail, supplies to be shuttled to the carrier from Da Nang. That was routine." And I said, "Don't you know that?" He says, "No." I said, "Well, you need to know things like this if you want to do this work. You need to know." Okay? He said it. It's consistent with history. It's a fact. He gets his benefit. And what, Kurt? Quite sure, but he got his money.
You know, and the thing that I like
there,
about Dr.
Judge,
Ash's sorry.
Yeah, Judge Hagel on the court wrote a very interesting opinion some years ago remanded a VA denial of a herbicide claim and said just that. He said that lay evidence is sufficient to prove a person's whereabouts. You cannot use the absence of documentation as proof of the negative. you have to point to other evidence. Like if this fella was in his service records, it placed him at a different place and time. Like this one, I had this one case, an army cook, southern part of Vietnam, swore that he fought with the Marines at Khe Sanh. And when I looked at his records, I saw that he had arrived in Vietnam the year after the battle at Khe Sanh. Okay, so I knew he did not fight with the Marines at Khe Sanh. So, you know, in that kind of circumstance, yes, you should deny. But in a particular instance where the veteran is giving us a sworn statement of where he was, when he was, what he experienced, what his symptoms were that he recalls, unless we have evidence to the contrary, it's to be accepted as factual. And then the doctor makes the link between those symptoms and the current disease or residuals of injury that we're looking for. And that's based on lay history of symptoms. It helps if we have treatment. It helps if we have some other documentation, even witnesses. But it's not necessary in all cases. And so there's still plenty of room to help educate the raters on that portion of the law and get a more of these things granted in that manner.
Right. And with Dr. Bash, with Dr. Bash's nexuses, what's really great about them is when he's giving his opinion on each disability, he actually refers to the lay statement in his nexus. So he has read the lay statements that we, together with the veteran, work on and forward them to Dr. Bash, and he uses them in his nexus. So that's where it becomes the whole package. You got your DBQs, the nexus, the lay statements, any kind of medical evidence that is attached to it. So I think it's just a whole complete claim package when you do all of it together.
And you work with the veteran to assist them in developing the lay statement? Because a lot of veterans wouldn't even know where to begin, of course.
Right, and that's where the whole conversation starts when you just sit and have just a normal conversation on the phone and just tell me about what's going on with your life, and then you're able to build that.
I noticed that about a few years ago. I found that it's hard for veterans to write those lay letters, so then Gail's come along now to help us, and then we have Megan also, because it's an important part of it, and so we're trying to make it easier for the veteran to get his story out.
Yeah, his thoughts down on paper, basically.
And with our understanding of the medicine from Dr. Bash, of the rules, okay, we're in a position to be able to ask the questions of the veteran to probe those precise questions that VA needs to understand. And the veteran can't do that on their own because they don't know what information to volunteer. We can help understand and in this way get an accurate recollection of their history of symptoms. And then Dr. Bass can explain why that tips the scale in favor of the conclusion that this is due to the service and injury as opposed to a car accident after service. Or as an example,
Well, a spine injury case was a classic example because the patient gave us the lay information about the scapula, the big bruise that she had, so that relates to nerves in the neck and the whole mechanism of injury, so it really helped us.
And then patients with TBI and PTSD, they really have a more difficult time kind of organizing their thoughts. That's why the conversation is so important, because then I can ask a question, like, oh, yeah, that happens to me all the time. And then they remember other parts of the story, other things that happened to them during the day, which is what I need to help them write their letter.
Yeah, it's particularly important in that people
yeah.
have head injuries, multiple sclerosis, because they have a hard time sometimes formulating their thoughts. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there, I recall one case where the veteran was stationed in Thailand, and he recalls that he had to land in Tonsonut in Vietnam. Okay? I said, well, when? And he had a really hard time. So I started talking to him about holidays and where were you on Christmas that year? What did you do at Christmas time? And he says, oh, I saw the Bob Hope Christmas show at Tonsonut that year. Bingo. Google. I said, who was in the show? He said, the Gold Diggers. Right. There it is, right there. Print this out. Here's the newspaper article. Bob Hope and the Gold Diggers at Tonsonut. So that's
mm-hmm.
it's evidence that tends to support. And you've got to trigger those memories and help
exactly.
them work, particularly with patients with emotional disorders, neurodisorders that affect the brain, memory issues with like PTSD. Oh my goodness. You know, they need help. They need
mm-hmm.
help to understand. I don't call it coaching. I call it soliciting. Give me your history. And so many times that history proves the case. You know, it's just happened so often.
Well, and then I've noticed that a lot of people, they're embarrassed to talk about the things that are happening to them, you know, so you have to kind of start out with just, hey, what's going on, and are you married, do you have kids, and then you get more comfortable, and then they feel more comfortable to talk about things that are happening in their life, because not everybody wants to talk about all the private things in their life going on.
That's right, and Gail, it takes a great skill like yours to be able to make them comfortable and to share in that way.
Yeah. Well, my husband always says that I have many words during the day to say, so I always tell him he's lucky that I'm talking to other people now. So I'm doing something good with all my words.
I also observe that patients with urinary and bowel dysfunction
mm-hmm.
are a little hesitant to talk about those things, and I
very
think
much.
They're oftentimes undercompensated for not sharing the fact that they're unable to retain contents. And so that's something that is another part of this equation for a lot of patients that we need to
that's a very good point.
Get them to talk about.
I teach medical students for a few decades, and medical students and doctors oftentimes avoid those issues too, you know. So I have my own spine injury and my own bowel and bladder problems, so I'm really comfortable about asking soldiers about that stuff because I know what my problems are and I know what kind of problems they have because they're similar. And so, you know, I think Gail's good about that and the rest of our team's good and Bill's good about that. So with us, we're going to ask all the veterans a lot of probing different types of questions, and I could teach medical students, as long as we have a good reason for it, we can ask anything you want, you know. So in this situation, we're asking questions to try and help you, you know, define your disease and how many times you have pads or how much leakage you have. Is all very important questions for the rater as far as the schedule goes and your benefits.
Right, and how that affects their daily life. Some vets that I've talked to are in the bathroom, you know, 20 times a day and up all night long. They might have sleep apnea, but they still have to get up because they're going to the bathroom all night. You know, those are symptoms that, you know, are disability. They're disabling symptoms, and they need to be part of
mm-hmm.
your disability.
So it sounds like you guys have put together a whole new program here, Dr. Batts.
Well, I'm slowly filling
we
up
evolve.
The team, but the VA, you know, the VA is getting harder and harder to get these cases through. You know, they have to have DVQs, you have to have Nexus, you have to have lay letters, you have to have testing. All these things we're doing are in response to what the VA needs for their rating. You know, Bill tells us that they've kind of restricted the rater's ability to get testing, and the rater doesn't have time to talk to the patient. So we're really just trying to provide what the VA needs to help them rate the patient correctly.
Well, yeah, and the more you can cut back on the remands and denials, the smoother the whole operation goes. You've saved the veteran a lot of heartaches, because to get a remand or denial is that's pretty rough to take when you know it's going to cost you mm-hmm. another 2 or 3 years or 4 or 5.
Right.
Yeah, we're trying to avoid that dreaded supplemental appeal. You know, that's going to be a little thorny when it starts getting cranked up, I think. What's that, Bill?
It's always been my experience that it is easier to have someone to agree with you than it is to change their mind. So it's better and faster if we give the adjudicators all the information they need to make the decision up front, load it all up front, and then make it easy for them to agree. That's much easier
to
do than to try to say to VA, you're wrong, because the reaction is, no, I'm not.
mm-hmm.
So it's better if we can get it all up front to begin with. But still, there's going to be some mistakes, even like mine. Right, Doc?
Yeah. Well, you can take the argument out of it. You have won your case.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, I got to thank Doc, too, because he explained to VA the anatomy of the shoulder. The service connected my shoulder and said service connected for the rotator cuff pair and not service connected for the muscles. Well, what's a rotator cuff pair?
Right.
Torn muscle.
Right.
It's kind of important because I had those muscles sewn back together. So, so it's all good now.
That's an important point that Bill brings up. You know, the idea that if you have a missile wound that goes through your arm, it's going to damage nerve, muscle, vessel. You know, so VA oftentimes, like the shoulder, Bill, they might give you, you know, DJD that will do a little bit of arthritis and call it a day, right? Where you might have also muscle and nerve damage, which is a very common thing that the VA doesn't think about when they rate, I think. Right, Bill?
True. Yeah, and they oftentimes wouldn't think of the muscles. The training that I experienced somewhat lacking. Take, for example, the hand. It seems if someone gets a hand injury, they're given a hand exam by the ortho, okay? And, okay, so you have some pain, and your fingers all touch your palms, and they have a reasonably full range of motion. So here's your 0%. Well, under 4.71A, under the 5200 series for the bones and joints, that's right. But under 4.73 muscles, it says the hand is so compact a structure that the minimum rating is 10%. You can't assign a hand injury less than 10%, no matter if your fingers can close up all the way. It's one of those things that experience gives you.
We're out of time, folks. Dr. Batch, if you want to give your phone number out again real quick.
Yep, 925-381-7561 for Skip, or Google Dr. Batch. You get me.
Okay, I appreciate you guys coming on. That's been a real informative show here. And I hope the veterans out there was able to take notes. If not, this will be in the archives. feel free to go to hadit.com and bring it up, and y'all can listen to it again. But
I just want you to know, Gerald, I've listened to all of them back 3 years. They're very good information. Yes.
We try to put out factual information as best we can.
You do.
Sometimes
that's where it goes.
You know, we have our issues.
That's our goal.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it.
Keep everyone informed. Feel free to call John or I anytime if you have any questions or comments or something you'd like, a topic you'd like us to hit on. I wouldn't be only too glad to.
I'll do that.
Work with.
Okay, Dr. Bash, I'll talk to you tomorrow. I'll see you later, Bill.
Yep. See you later.
Okay.
Have a good night.
Good
have a good day. Thanks for radio.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for calling in.
Gentlemen, I don't think we've accomplished the mission here. I believe we're about halfway through, so we're going to have to do this again real soon in order to try to at least get some more additional information out there, because this is probably the most popular series we've had, so we need to increase a little bit if you guys have time to do shows.
Yeah. We'll get another one scheduled. We've been having some technical issues. My machine quit taking quarters and now wants half dollars. I don't know why. But we keep working. But anyway, thanks for calling in. You got to do a good job.
Welcome. Thanks for the show. It's good information. Yeah. Bye.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Bye.
Well, Drew, it's probably no reason to play the ending, so.
Yeah, we done run out of time.
That's all right.
Well, that's
we'll
all
do this
right.
Again here. We'll try to get these guys back on in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And I'm not going to play the thing a couple times.
That's some good information there. People can use that. Yep. So, and that's the main thing is see to it that we're able to get the word out to everyone that can listen that, you know, get us some benefit.
Okay.
So, we're looking good here.
Oh, yeah. A lot better quality show this time.
Yeah, I'm glad I bought this headset down there at that room. That thing really, did you get any background noise?
I got a little bit of shakiness there. I think you might have grabbed your headset once or something. So like you'd beat the dog to death or something for a minute, but it's all right.
Oh, man. Well, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm picking my nose, maybe.
Be careful, you black eyes do that. But I found it. I know a job you can get. I know the hiring too.
Yeah, bartender. Make good.
No,
bartender.
No, no. You go to Lowe's. Lowe's is hiring paint shakers.
Paycheck. Yeah. I can do that. Become a paint salesman.
Paint shaker. Yeah. You know, at shaking paint, you can Louise go to Lowe's and you can buy your gallon of paint time you get home with a t-shirt.
it'd be all messed up.
All right. Well, listen, I'll catch you later. Couldn't shut her down, and I'll give you a call later on. I might replay this tomorrow, next day.
Okay.
We'll do that. All right.
Yeah, you can. That'd be a good idea.
All right.
Should be a good show. It is good. Well, it's a good informative. That's what we need.
Very. A lot of traffic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's
well,
good.
We will have. Yeah. We'll have.
All righty.
Okay, folks.
Catch you later,
buddy. We'll talk to you later. Bye.